I've been an officer here in Juneau for 16 years, and I've never seen anything like this.
Juneau police put together the details of a bizarre crime spree. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Tuesday, December 10th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, Savoonga residents celebrate the second bowhead in just 1 week.
This replaced a lot of our walrus meat, and there's a lot of happy stomachs out there.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by First National Bank Alaska, helping Alaska's dreams grow since 1922. On the web at fnbalaska.com, an equal housing lender, member FDIC. Many Alaska business owners are paying too much for energy. The Commercial Building Energy Audit Program identifies an average of 30% in energy savings. The application period runs November 1st through December 20th. To learn more, visit akenergyefficiency.org. This message sponsored by the Alaska Energy Authority.
An Alaska commuter plane in which four people died last month had changed course from one small Alaska village to another because of deteriorating weather. A preliminary report by the National Transportation Safety Board says pilot Terry Hansen diverted from a scheduled landing in Mountain Village to St. Mary's and flew over the latter community's airport before the plane crashed on November 29th. A mile away. The preliminary findings gives few details as to the possible cause of the crash of the Hägglunds Aviation Cessna 208 turboprop. The plane was not required to carry a cockpit voice recorder or flight data recorder. Hansen and three passengers, 57-year-old Rose Pulte, 65-year-old Richard Pulte, and 5-month-old baby Wyatt Coffey, died in the crash. Six other passengers sustained serious injuries. Officials and court records have revealed new arrests and information in Friday's shooting and bogus kidnapping in Juneau, now tying it to drugs and an early morning highway gunfight that no one had reported to police. The case involves heroin, which has become extremely profitable in the capital city in the last few years. KTOO's Jeremy Shea has the story.
When police shut down the outbound lanes of Egan Drive late Friday morning, they now say they were searching for evidence from a highway gunfight stemming from a drug deal. Friday's shooting at the Coho Park Apartments after midnight was followed by an early morning exchange of gunfire from two moving vehicles on Egan Drive involving at least four people. According to a press release the Juneau Police Department put out Monday, there were no injuries in the second shooting, and it went unreported. Police shut down the outbound lanes of Juneau's main road artery by 10:22 a.m. Friday to collect evidence. Juneau Police Lieutenant Chris Sell says it's been a very complicated case.
I've been an officer here in Juneau for 16 years, and I've never seen anything like this, where you have a shooting, and then the parties go their separate ways, and then there's another shooting, and yeah, this is unique.
The department is still processing evidence and trying to pin down timelines. Police have seized an undisclosed amount of heroin. Recent busts indicate the drug street value has skyrocketed from about $136 per gram in 2011 to $1,000 per gram now.
It's extremely profitable to deal heroin, so that can tempt people into the business, but clearly it's a very high-risk business.
So far in the alleged drug deal, turned shooting, turned highway gunfight, turned faux kidnapping, police have arrested three people, all Juneau residents. 44-year-old James DePasquale. Police say DePasquale was shot twice at the Coho Park Apartments and was taken to the hospital from the scene. Court records show charges for 7 felonies and 1 misdemeanor pending against DePasquale that are consistent with drug dealing, gunplay, and tampering with evidence. They also show that about 11 hours before he was shot, the courts had issued a warrant for his arrest. He'd been on probation for an assault in July.
So you got one guy in the hospital, but the conflict is continuing. And the person whose buddy got shot goes and recruits another friend.
Sell says those two people were involved in the highway shooting with 24-year-old Jarrell Torres. Court records show he's facing 2 felony charges. One is for drugs, the other is for gunplay, specifically from a moving vehicle. The vehicle hunt that police solicited the public's help with Friday was for a truck that Torres reportedly left the initial shooting in. However, officials picked him up around 8:12 a.m. Friday in a sedan with 26-year-old Amanda Phillips. Phillips is facing a felony charge for tampering with evidence. Police accuse her of hiding the handgun that DePasquale used. The three appeared in court today to set bail. More hearings are expected later this month. Police have mentioned one more person somehow involved, but haven't identified her by name, a 22-year-old woman who reported her kidnapping and escape from Torres. Police now say she was voluntarily involved with De Pasquale and Torres, and that the kidnapping was likely a fabrication. With help from Matt Miller, in Juneau, I'm Jeremy Shea.
For more than 80 years, hundreds of polar bear skulls from St. Lawrence Island have been sitting in the American Museum of Natural History in New York City. Now, under NAGPRA, the Native American Graves Protection and Repatriation Act, the artifacts may be returning to the tribe that buried them. KNOM's Anna Rose MacArthur reports.
Between the 1930s and 1950s, Dr. Otto Geist, who was at the time affiliated with the University of Alaska Fairbanks, excavated hundreds of animal bones, mostly polar bear skulls, from human burial sites on St. Lawrence Island. The oldest artifacts, according to a notice by the National Park Service, date from about 200 BC to 580 and derive from the old Bering Sea culture of the island. Many bones were taken from the grave of the hunter and whaler Kowarin. The remaining bones were extracted from the Kukulik Eskimo burial mound. Because these items were removed from burial sites, they classify as funerary objects, and though their extraction at the time was legal, the 1990 passage of NAGPRA gives the tribes and lineal descendants associated with the items the right to claim ownership of the objects. And this week, after several years of historical, genealogical, and oral history research by the Bureau of Land Management and the American Natural History Museum, the BLM is contacting the objects' associated entities, descendants in the native village of Gamble and the native village of Savunga, with the option of repatriating the artifacts. Robert King, BLM Alaska State NAGPRA coordinator, says about a dozen similar repatriations have occurred in Alaska since NAGPRA's passage. And this process, King says, is not only respectful, but healing.
It's a recognition that tribes and individuals, they connect to specific sets of either human remains or burial objects or items, sacred items or items of cultural patrimony.
According to a National Park Service notice, no human remains were removed during these excavations. Reporting from Nome, I'm Anna Rose MacArthur.
Amid an economic disaster and food shortage, Savunga, a community on St. Lawrence Island, harvested a 57-foot bowhead whale on Friday, the second whale for the community last week. For 8 hours on Friday, Isaac Kalawi, president of the Savunga Whaling Captains Association, says whaling crews fought 13 miles of opposing tides and currents to tow the giant bowhead to land. Then most of Savunga, men, women, children, and elders, gathered on the beach to help haul the animal ashore.
Every time Savunga gets a whale, especially this time of the year, it's a real blessing for the community. Everybody gets together and work as one person.
Kalawi says the meat was shared throughout the community and with Gamble, the other village on the island. These two whales come amid an island-wide food shortage. After gathering one-third of its yearly walrus harvest, St. Lawrence Island declared an economic disaster in August. Perry Pingawi, alternative commissioner for the Savunga Whaling Captains Association, says the whales substitute for a sizable portion of this year's lost subsistence take.
Replaced a lot of our walrus meat, and there's a lot of happy stomachs out there. You can't compare it with walrus, but these two whales are a substantial portion of what we don't have in our homes is food.
Though the whales substitute some of this year's lost walrus protein, the whales do not replace the walrus's lost ivory, an important cash source for many of the island's residents and their families. The whales were Savunga's two final strikes of the year, an annual quota set by the Alaska Eskimo Whaling Commission. It is extremely unusual to harvest whales so late in the year. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, Accutan puts its airport shuttle, a hovercraft, into retirement.
It looks like we could save upwards of $1 million and maybe more depending on how it goes.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Alaska Premier Dental Group, offering restorative, preventive, and cosmetic dentistry with three offices, two in Anchorage and one in Wasilla. Description of services at smilealaska.com. And by Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, committed to safety, operating the 800-mile Trans-Alaska Pipeline for 35 years.
The State Department of Transportation is considering a highway project that would route the park's highway around Wasilla instead of through it. The small Matanuska-Susitna Borough community has long been at the center of park's highway congestion, since vehicles have to pass through traffic signals at local intersections while traveling through the city. Murph O'Brien is a senior transportation planner with HDR Consultants, the firm heading the study. He presented the latest information on the proposed highway reroute to Wasilla's City Assembly last night. O'Brien says the plan is prompted by projections for Matsu population growth.
40 years from now, they're looking at a population of close to 400,000 people. So to address that, we need to take a look into the future as to what the transportation needs are. And currently, there's traffic issues on the park's highway through downtown Wasilla. And the choices are either to add more lanes through downtown Wasilla or to look at, you know, is it still possible to go south of Wasilla with a controlled access freeway type facility.
DOT has received a $2 million state general fund legislative appropriation to develop a solution to the park's congestion problem. O'Brien says so far there is no cost estimate for the work. Another aim of the project is to create a more livable downtown area for Wasilla residents. For more than a year, getting in and out of Accutan has meant taking a hovercraft. The vessel ferries passengers to and from the island's airport. But high costs and inconsistent service have sent the Aleutians East Borough looking for a better solution. Now, as KUCB's Annie Ropeek reports, they think they found one.
Accutan's airport isn't on Accutan. It sits on neighboring Akoon Island across about 6 miles of choppy straits. Last year, the Aleutians East Borough started using a hovercraft to get people to and from the airport, but Borough Manager Rick Gifford says the vessel's expenses have gotten out of hand.
Most of the crew is brought up from Seattle. It's four or five people at a time that have to be on the hovercraft. It was costing the borough over $3 million a year, and it's just not sustainable.
He's hoping to cut those costs by replacing the hovercraft with a helicopter. The borough is going to lease the aircraft from a company in Homer.
It looks like we could save upwards of $1 million and maybe more, depending on how it goes.
Marty Robbins is the general manager of Hoverlink, the Seattle company that's managed the hovercraft for the borough. He says the partnership is ending on good terms, and he's happy with the service they've provided. Robbins says the hovercraft has been able to operate about 70% of the time since it started running.
And that's, you know, about what we thought it would be going into it, was that we would have that sort of weather and sea condition limitations.
Gifford says the helicopter will definitely have days where bad weather keeps it grounded too, but he's hoping those will coincide with closures and groundings at the airport. That hasn't been the case with the hovercraft.
There were days when the airplane could come over and the hovercraft couldn't operate because of sea conditions, and there were days when it was foggy and the hovercraft could run and the airplane couldn't run. But with the helicopter, it'll be more consistent with what the airplane can do.
The helicopter only holds 6 passengers as compared to 40 on the hovercraft. Gifford says they'll make up the difference in speed. It takes the helicopter 6 minutes to get to Akoon, while the hovercraft took 30 or 40 minutes. The helicopter does have weight limitations, and it won't be able to haul fuel or vehicles like the hovercraft could. Accutan's mayor, Joe Boreskin, says they're still deciding what to do about that. But Gifford, the borough manager, says the rest of the service should stay the same. That includes the fees that passengers will have to pay to get to the airport. A one-way ticket will still be $100. Gifford says even the helicopter isn't a permanent solution. Eventually, they'd like to return to the water to connect Accutan to its airport.
We feel the ultimate solution is that someday we need to have a dock and a breakwater on the Akoon Island where the airport is, and then run a conventional vessel back and forth.
That could take 3 to 5 years to set up, to say nothing of funding. Meanwhile, the helicopter is due to start flying alongside the hovercraft in February. They'll overlap service for about 2 weeks before the hovercraft goes into storage and the helicopter becomes a full-time airport taxi. In Unalaska, I'm Annie Ropeek.
The Alaska State Museum in Juneau is getting a lot of help from other Alaska museums ahead of its move to a new facility in 2016. As the staff works to pack up the more than 32,000 artifacts in its collection, museum professionals from around the state are lending a hand and learning what it takes to safely store and transport priceless historical objects. KTOO's Casey Kelly has more.
In the basement of the Alaska State Museum, Eva Malvich uses a box cutter to slice a thin piece of gray cardboard into a small rectangle. Mounted on the cardboard, supported by four pieces of foam, is a makeup brush with an ornately carved metal handle. Malvich doesn't know much about the brush, except that it came from a woman who collected items for her vanity.
But then, you know, with objects, you have to preserve them forever.
Malvich is director of the tribally owned Upete Pajarialite Museum in Bethel. The name means the people's way of living.
We're the only museum in the Delta.
After a career in public administration, Malvich started working at the museum about a year ago. She had no practical experience, so she's learning the best way to handle and preserve objects. She points to a piece of cardboard like the one on which she just mounted the makeup brush.
I used to wonder what the heck this was. So we have boxes of this. I used to think, why do I have so much cardboard? Now I know it's called blueboard, and it's useful for making containers for my objects.
Malvich is learning under the direction of husband and wife team Scott and Ellen Carley. Ellen is the Alaska State Museum conservator. Scott is curator of museum services. His job is to assist and advise other museums and historical societies throughout the state.
I help them with projects that they're working on. I help them get grants. I actually have a small grant that I can give out to help them do projects. I can do assessments.
Carley says other Alaska museum professionals had been asking him how the museum planned to move its collection to a new state library, archives, and museum building scheduled to open in 2016. That's how he got the idea to bring them to Juneau to see it firsthand.
I thought, well, it would be really nice to have them help me, but I'd feel bad if it was, you know, on their own nickel. So I thought, you know, we should at least try and pay for their travel expenses. So I wrote this grant to the Institute for Museums and Library Services to help fund this travel down here as a professional development opportunity for these museum professionals throughout Alaska.
The grant is for $83,000, which the State Museum is matching. Carley says each museum professional will get to visit Juneau twice, once during the packing and planning phase, and again during the actual move.
We're calling them EXOs, because outside museum professionals is a little hard to say all the time and to write down. So EXOs just, we kind of think of it as like external operative or something. You know, somebody from the outside is coming in to help us.
Angelie Grantham is curator of collections at the Baranoff Museum in Kodiak. Located inside the Russian American Magazine, a two-story log structure built in 1808, it houses a treasure trove of colonial Alaska history. The museum's not moving anytime soon, but Grantham says the staff is redesigning all of its exhibits.
That's going to mean that a lot of the objects that are currently in collection storage are going to be on exhibit, so it's going to require a lot of shuffling of things. It's a perfect opportunity to implement some of these new solutions.
Grantham had some experience preserving and caring for objects prior to working for the Baranoff Museum. Still, she says the opportunity to learn from the staff at the Alaska State Museum is unique.
This is what they do. You know, they conserve objects and they create these really amazing storage solutions for fragile objects of many different types of materials. It's kind of like now I'm here under the tutelage of masters.
Grantham and Malvich were the fourth group of EXOs to visit Juneau as part of the project. The grant is providing travel for 27 museum professionals from 12 Alaska institutions. Carley says he works with between 60 and 70 museums around the state. In Juneau, I'm Casey Kelly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
The Kinnick Arm Bridge and Toll Authority is developing the Kinnick Arm Crossing to further develop the transportation system between Anchorage and the Matsu Borough. The bridge could create construction jobs, provide access to land for commercial, industrial, and residential development, and shorten the route to Alaska's interior and North Slope. There's more information on the Kinnick Arm Bridge at kinnickarmbridge.com. This message sponsored by the Kinnick Arm Bridge and Toll Authority. The Older Persons Action Group, publisher of Senior Voice, Alaska's only statewide newspaper for older Alaskans and their families, can be read online at seniorvoicealaska.com. This message sponsored by OPAG.
A Fairbanks green technology advocate is trying to muster interest in an alternative model for financing energy and other projects. Fairbanks resident Robert Shields runs the local nonprofit Alliance for Reason and Knowledge. Shields, who's pushed for hydroponic agriculture as a use for the derelict Polaris building, says a model employed to finance community solar projects in the lower 48 could be applied in Alaska.
Community solar in itself is defined as the shared ownership of a centralized energy system with benefits to multiple partners. We're basically looking at this and potentially taking out the solar part and putting in anything, including gas pipelines, Susitna dams, new power plants, to encourage investment from the free market into building an infrastructure for Alaska so we don't have to continue burdening state funding.
Shields is exploring ownership and financing models laid out in a guide recently released by the National Renewable Energy Laboratory. He says the city of Boulder, Colorado, built a large solar panel project using the public-private financing model, which also relies on federal tax credits.
There are renewable energy tax credits. There are new market tax credits, which basically are for innovation in different aspects of the market, but depending on the nature of the projects, there are just a bunch of different financial elements, and the community solars provide some insight on how we might be able to bundle the cost, share some of the risk, and overcome the high capital cost that's been facing a lot of these infrastructure projects.
Shield says there's some urgency to working the model now, as the tax credits may not be around much longer. The Alaska Department of Transportation has a new tool in the war on icy roads. KUAC's Dan Bross reports.
That's the sound of a Finnish-made Rayco icebreaker hard at work.
It attaches to the front of a plow and it's basically like a rotating drum with metal spikes.
State Department of Transportation spokeswoman Hannah Blankenship says the state purchased one of the machines and has been testing it in Fairbanks over the last couple of weeks.
As we see these freezing rain events in Fairbanks and in the interior, this is one of the many pieces of equipment that DOT Maintenance and Operations is using to combat the conditions and make the roads a little easier for drivers.
Blankenship says the icebreaker will also be tested in other areas of the state. The DOT plans to buy two more of the machines. In Fairbanks, I'm Dan Bross.
Popular footwear brand Extra Tough is on a mission to prove to their disappointed loyal customers that the iconic boots are not just sort of tough. 2 years ago, parent company Honeywell transferred production of Extra Tough from Illinois to a factory in China, and the product that rolled off the line was nowhere near what Alaskans had come to expect. Extra Tough says the quality is back, and they want to replace any pairs purchased that didn't hold up, no questions asked. KDLG's Dave Benninger has more.
At the Extra Tough's booth at the recent Pacific Marine Expo in Seattle, one needed not wait long to hear from disgruntled customers who'd bought some of the first non-made in the USA boots.
It wasn't what I expected. The laminating on the front toe would go come undone, and the Extra Tough would leak. And you try to do your best. You go put goop on it. You try to go burn it and melt it back together.
Longtime wearers and newcomers to the brand were shocked when the waterproof boots gave way in months, even weeks. Some said rumor alone was enough for them to give up on Extra Toughs.
I needed boots down here, and I didn't buy them because I knew they were crappy. Everyone said that they were falling apart, so I just didn't buy the boots.
It's said that a third of all Extra Toughs end up in the state of Alaska. Many fishermen favor them for their easy traction on nets and lines, but loyal customers say they'd come to expect years of use out of a pair of Extra Toughs, not just one season or less.
2 to 3 years is what they used to last, we wear them out, just rip them apart, but last few years, they just were, 2 months, maybe a month, maybe. They just broke, ripped apart.
Honeywell felt the heat as disappointed consumers railed away online and to their local retailers. Even Senator Mark Begich fired off a letter to the company decrying the poor quality, expressing his hope that the production would come back to the U.S. A According to Honeywell, that's not going to happen, but they do say that the problems have now been fixed. The quality is back. And as Global Director of Footwear Sean O'Brien says, they're going to great lengths to prove it to their customers.
If you had a pair of boots that had any kind of leaking or any the lining might have had any issues or anything, we'll replace them, no questions asked, full refund, swap them out. And I think that's the best thing we can do because we guarantee our product.
O'Brien and a few Extra Tufts reps delivered their product guarantee message over and again at the expo, lubricating it with a posh Drinks on Us reception and giving away what seemed hundreds of new pairs of boots and shoes.
We have incredibly loyal customers. People are passionate about the brand. We want to make sure that they're well taken care of. And that's why that's why we're here, is to make sure that we're out front and talking to people. And if anyone's having problems, we have no problem talking to them and making sure that they're happy and swapping out their boots, whatever we need to do.
Some speculate that what went wrong with the first year of Chinese-made Extra Tufts had to do with cheap glue. Others say that the 25 sets of hands that handle each boot on the line had not been trained properly. O'Brien toes a careful company line, going only so far as to say that making boots is not an exact science and that, indeed, there were some hiccups.
Just through trial and error and building out and getting a new line up to speed, we ran into some problems as far as some issues with some of our boots. But as of right now, and after the past 9 months, we've had no issues with any of our products. Everything has been performing even above expectations, and it's really come to fruition at this show. You know, the consumers and accounts and retailers, according to it, it's like, they're fixed, they're great.
Many at the Pacific Marine Expo took home free boots. Most adhered to the old adage of not looking a gift boot in the toe. Most also seem satisfied with the company's efforts to win them back.
Now that they're willing to go fix their mistake, I'm willing to give them a second chance.
They want to take the boots back and then keep up the reputation of having the highest customer service as well as the highest quality product. So I think it's great marketing on their part, and then it's good for fishermen because most of us aren't made of money because we're fishermen.
We just got a free pair now, so it's just with any small business. I totally understand. They take care of you, and you got to take care of them, I guess, you know, just can't give up.
Time or another fishing season will tell if the boots are sort of or extra tough now, or somewhere in between, perhaps. One more note, in Begich's letter to Honeywell, he casually added that people want the extra tough beer koozie back, and that, Honeywell says, they can do. One rep said to look for them back on store shelves by early next year. In Dillingham, I'm Dave Benninger.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. We had reports tonight from Jeremy Shea and Casey Kelly in Juneau, Anna Rose MacArthur in Nome, Ellen Lockyer in Anchorage, Annie Ropeek in Unalaska, Dan Bross in Fairbanks, and Dave Benninger in Seattle. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Josh Edge is our web producer. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible in part by your local public radio station. Join Alaska bars and restaurants from every corner of the state in taking a stand against secondhand smoke. The fact of the matter is, no Alaskan, employee, or customer should suffer the heart disease and lung cancer due to secondhand smoke. The benefits are undeniably positive for Alaskans and for the bottom line. Clean indoor air. It's good for health, and it's great for business. For more information on smoke-free workplaces, visit alaskatca.org. This message sponsored by the Alaska Tobacco Control Alliance. Many Alaska business owners are paying too much for energy. The Commercial Building Energy Audit Program identifies an average of 30% in energy savings. The application period runs November 1st through December 20th. To learn more, visit akenergyefficiency.org. This message sponsored by the Alaska Energy Authority.
Public Education Health Trust, formerly NEA, Alaska Health Plan, delivers cost-effective health plans for Alaska families. They help Alaska's education professionals, from school bus drivers to teachers, manage their health plan benefits efficiently. Public Education Health Trust provides members with low-cost plans, more choices, and local control, advocating for 17,000 Alaskans and their health care needs. This message sponsored by Public Education Health Trust.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.